what I'm going to be doing today, and in some ways it's good it's a small group because maybe we can get to some discussion, is that I have been working with youth, not with you so much, but on problems concerning youth, public policy problems, working for the Illinois Caucus on Teenage Pregnancy, concerned with teenage pregnancy. At the same time that I've been doing that, I have been concerned with urban policy issues and the questions of the inner city, and just the, not just the inner city, but Chicago specifically as a whole, and how a city functions, right? So those two issues have both been things that have interested me for a long time. And also as a human being motivated since at least adolescence, the question of justice and why are things the way they are when they shouldn't be this way has always been something that concerns me. And I'm putting, in really this talk, putting these three things together in terms of the issues of youth and poverty. A book that I had asked the bookstore to get and they couldn't get it, but I really wanted to really, I'm getting a commission, tout this book. It's called The Truly Disadvantaged by William Julius Wilson, who's a professor at the University of Chicago in sociology. He is a black academic and basically one of the leading academics. And this book has, in academic circles and public policy circles, taken off. You know, and everybody's talking about it, and he's suddenly being called to Washington to confer with people, more liberal Democrats and stuff like that. And he had written another book, which had a lot of problems because of its title, which is Race is Not Enough. And he was criticized by a lot of people as saying that he thought that racism was no longer a problem. And he wasn't saying that. He thinks that black people in this country, obviously himself included, have a difficult time because of racism. But what this book asks is one of the questions it asks is why is it in the last 20 years when we've had some of the most astounding civil rights legislation in the country, are blacks economically worse off than they were 20 years earlier? Okay, which is the case. Now there have certain things that happened. There's more of a stable black middle class now. But as a group, they're worse off economically. Within them, as I said, there's a middle class and there's thin integration and there's more black college graduates and stuff like that. So he was asking that question. And he takes a very poor, impoverished community in Chicago and does a lot of work on that and has a lot of answers, which isn't specifically about youth, but a lot of the poor blacks are youth, so it's tied in together. So I'm taking a lot of his thoughts and a lot of statistics and information from other sources and putting it together for this lecture. Maybe we can have some conversations about it earlier. Later. I'm all right. This is my good friend Hershey's candy bar to give me a little adrenaline.
I know. Before this those beans weren't enough. It's
you know, what does poverty look like is one question that I had. My parents both came over from the old country, and my mother came over in steerage. I was, my father did too, but my mother has some stories about it just before the First World War. And my mother's family came over. They were poor. They were poor immigrants, like many other of our families who came over who were poor immigrants.
Where did you come from?
Greece, yeah. And yet there was a sense that there was an American dream, the whole Horatio Alger American dream that we know wasn't true, but that there was a sense that life would improve. And if you worked hard, your children's life would be better than your life. And that is true. There is no question. My mother was taken out of school and never went past sixth grade. I am a college graduate. You know, I mean, and so in a sense, you know, my earning potential is much greater than my mother's was at her age, at the same age. So that it's true that things have gotten better. And many of us, if we look back in our family histories, we'll see that we are better off than our grandparents or parents were, that they had children that they carried on a legacy to. And that view of things. Now, there have always been people who have been caught, who have been poor, and there's been generations of poor. Now, what's happened in this country is we've always had an expanding economy. So although there was always poor and impoverished, there was a chance for some sort of jobs. So, for example, for the majority of blacks in this country, which I would say because of racism, have often been put in the most unstable, poor positions economically, even for them, because there were, for example, they were in the South where there was a lot of discrimination. As in the industrial North, jobs opened up, they came, they got the worst jobs, but there were jobs. You know, and even though that there were a large amount of them were on welfare, that a larger amount of them weren't on welfare. And that their children, there are many blacks that their children are better off than they were. I mean, at least that was true from the 20s and 30s. They came north. Their children were better off. Their children became civil servants and teachers. There was that sense, even for them, for all Americans, that this was the case. At the same time, the poor communities in this country were not that different than the middle-class communities. And what I mean by that is they were often the same communities. That in, for example, the poor immigrant Greek community, and I think you can translate this, there would be the people who were working for very little wages, there would be the doctor, there would be the lawyer, we went to the same church, the school teacher, there was a connection with each other. And often in our extended family, some people would make it before others, some were restaurant workers, some were restaurant owners. That was true like in Harlem during the 30s or 40s. You had the black middle class, the teachers, the civil servants, working with, living in the same community, going to the same churches, sending their children on the whole to the same schools as the impoverished. And so the community had a lot of networks and a lot of access together. One of the things that's happened now in terms of poverty is that there is more economic segregation. We did an interesting map in Chicago. Chicago, I think, has the acclaim of being the most segregated city in the northern part of the country, housing-wise. And we have a horrible, dismal picture. And but it was interesting, we were showing segregation patterns haven't changed in some neighborhoods, like the neighborhood I live on in the near north side of Chicago, has in fact improved. That among middle-class communities, there is more integration. As long as you can pay for your condo, it doesn't matter what the color of your skin is, sort of ideally, or for your $250,000 townhouse. But at the same time, that we were looking at communities and doing a color drawing of them in terms of economic segregation, and we found out that on the whole, that the black communities and a lot of the ethnic communities were less integrated economically than they had been 30 or 40 years ago. And what that means in some of those communities is you've lost the middle class, you've lost that networking, you've lost some of the leadership that would have been there yelling for good schools, that perhaps would, your child needed a job, and there was someone who was a city worker or a civil servant or someone who worked from the union down the block from you, and they could help your child get a job even if you were unemployed. You know what I mean? That there was that access to those kinds of things. That stuff is less likely in Chicago. You're going to have to look at your own communities to think that some of the stuff I'm saying is making sense, but I'm just talking to you the studies that were done in one urban area. So, all right, so I just wanted to give that broad brush sort of thing about what I think some of the differences in poverty are. Now I just want to tell you a few of the facts of poverty. Some of you know them, but I just want to go through them. One is, a lot of people think people get rich on welfare. Actually, the average welfare payment is $4 a day a person. Okay, now when I'm saying $4 a day a person, that $4 is not only for food, it's also for lodging. Okay, so you get a sort of sense of what that can pay. So for a family of three, you would have basically $12 a day times 30 days. of a month, and you would have to pay for food, and you'd have to pay for lodging, and you'd have to pay for clothes and incidentals from that amount of money. That this money has not been indexed for inflation. It does not go up every year. So, for example, in the state of Illinois, because it's been the most powerless group and the thing that has been cut in the last 10, people on welfare now are actually getting less than they were getting 10 years ago because of the inflationary situation that's occurred in this country. There are 32 million poor people in this country. 13 million of them, one-third, are children. In fact, if you take every group in this country, if you take children, if you take the middle-aged, and if you take the old, and you compare them, the poorest group is children. They are impoverished. Now, the majority of the poor are working. When I'm saying giving you this idea of welfare payments, I want you to understand the majority of poor are working. But they do not meet the level of poverty as defined as what's needed to live in this country. So they're called the working poor. They're often the ones, too, that don't have insurance and are in very marginal kinds of work that get laid off first or they can't get full-time jobs. Now, 7 million people of this poor group of people and 7 million people in general are unemployed in this country. That means that they have worked. They are now looking for work. That's the definition of unemployed. You have to register that you're looking for work. But only 28.6 of them are receiving unemployment compensation, which means that most of them have been out of work more than 6 months, because usually for the first 6 months you receive some form of unemployment compensation, you know, depending on your job history. Of people 20 to 24, there's actually a 27% unemployment rate. And how this goes, and let me get this a little, let me just leave that for a minute and come back to it, because I've already wrote it, doesn't make sense to put it somewhere else. The present minimum wage is $3.35 an hour.
$3.35.
We're trying to change that right now in the legislature. We've been trying to do that for a few years, in Congress. That means that for a family of three, in other words, a young family, mother, father, and child, that leaves them below the poverty line. They are, in fact, only 71% of what's needed for them to be out of poverty. For a family of four, this is only 56%. So one of the things I'm going to be getting into later is young families being impoverished. And by the definition of being young and a parent equaling poverty, and you can see that if you have two 17-year-olds who become parents, marry, and drop out of school, and the boy gets a minimum wage job, he is not going to make it to the poverty line. He's not going to even make it to that point. And, you know, if they have, for some reason, two children, and then they're only halfway there. Now, 35 million Americans lack health insurance. All right. Now, young parents are more likely to be poor, which I said earlier. Now, some other figures, just to give you a sense. The average cost of buying a house, which I am trying to do now and can attest to, is $84,300. That was in 1985. In 1975, it was only $39,300. Isn't that a trip?
39?
Yeah. I know this as a fact right now. But
don't you wish?
Don't I wish? I mean, kick myself for 1985, you know, which is the latest figure I have, the average cost of buying a house was $84,300.
Okay.
In 1975, 10 years earlier, it was $39,300.
Lots of times now you can't even find a lot
for that. Oh, I know.
What's the difference in the minimum wage there in that period?
I'm going to get into that in a minute. The minimum wage is actually going down. Because, all right, and I'll get into it. Just to give you another sense of what the average wage in this country is $29,458, with the average wage for whites being $30,809, for blacks $17,604, and for Hispanics $19,995.
The average wage for a white family?
Is $30,000.
That's the average?
Yeah. Yes, it puts up.
We balance that. We're not below the poverty line.
And then for black families, it's $17,000. I'll leave off the.
Now there you're talking.
You're in the wrong category.
Okay, so this gives you some sense. I'm just, again, I'm doing a broad brush.
What's a poverty line, Christine? What?
I can't remember.
What? 4,000?
No, 4.
For four people.
I don't know the answer to that because I only know for Illinois, in which the poverty for a family of three, it's considered to be $7,000.
See, I thought it was nationally. I thought NPR said 12,000 for four.
Right.
Below 12,000, I think, was what.
Right, but what happens is that different states have different poverty levels. Interesting, Illinois has a poverty, I'm just giving this, you can look up for your own state. Illinois has a poverty level that's less, in other words, and the reason the poverty level becomes important only in that it tells you when you can get some kind of benefits and can't get other kinds of benefits. You know, I mean, that's why it's of a bureaucratic importance. In Illinois, even though it's lower than the national one, we only give welfare families 47% of what we say it's needed. We say that a poor family needs $7,000, a family three, but we only give them $4,000 or something like that, or less than that. So, you know, even by their own standards, the governmental structure is breaking down. Now, a lot of, especially among blacks, but of there are 22,000 whites who are poor, and 7,000, a little more than that, but I'm gonna round off, almost 8,000 are children. There are 9,000 blacks that are poor. 4,000 of them are children. So about one third of the whites are children who are poor. 50% almost of the blacks who are poor are children. And about half of the Hispanics, 5.1% of the Hispanics are poor. I mean, not 5 million Hispanics are poor, 2.4 of them are children.
And how many whites again?
22 million.
22 million are poor?
Yeah.
And 9 million blacks?
And 9 million blacks, and 5.1. I mean, you have to understand that in all these figures, that blacks, you know, when you have an image of poverty, you often have an image of a minority. That is not true. The average person who is poor is white because the average person in this country is white. Because of functional racism, which, you know, we can talk about a little, the blacks have a higher percentage of their population are poor. So there's a higher percentage of blacks are poor than the percentage of whites are poor. But as a whole, there are still more whites that are poor than blacks.
Hard to see.
What?
Rural poverty is hard to see.
Right, it is. But yeah. I mean, in Illinois, some of the poorest areas are in southern Illinois, or in the poverty areas. There's no question about that. Okay. Now, if you look at the poor children, obviously, the two issues that become the most glaring, and where they get behind the middle-class child, we won't even talk about other kinds of issues, is health and education. And what I have here is something interesting. Now, obviously, on a lot of these issues, their families can't pay for this, right? We've already shown you that the families get very little money, so it's going to be some form of government or societal support that's going to help them out. Well, I have this is where your tax money goes. And this is just federal money, and a lot of programs, you know, in the last 10 years under Nixon and then under Reagan have been put into the state, so it doesn't count those figures, okay? But still, to give you some idea, 32.9% of your tax money goes to national defense. That's national defense, military retirement, veterans benefit, and international affairs. Now, 13.7% of your tax money, and I want you to keep this figure in mind, and you'll see in a minute, goes to pay our national debt.
Which is also partly military.
Right, exactly, because you have to take all the figures, so obviously one-third of it is military, because one-third of it. Then 8.4% goes to agriculture, transportation, science, energy, and the environment. Then 31.7% goes to Social Security, railroad retirement, federal employee retirement, which again, it won't go to military retirement, but it will go to some other stuff that will be in other categories. Medicare, which is welfare, I mean, Medicare, which is welfare in terms of, not welfare, in terms of Social Security, right? We know what that is. And then Medicaid, which is welfare health care, but not for children and their caretakers. It's only the Medicaid that is like for senior citizens or the disabled. It's not AFDC. That accounts for 31.7%. Then 7% of your money goes to food stamps, housing and energy assistance, unemployment. Only 5.3% of your money goes to children's programs directly. Medicaid for children and caretakers, child nutrition and WIC, AFDC and child support, that's the welfare payments, earned income tax credit payments, health care services, education, higher education, job training, summer youth employment, Job Corps, social service, Head Start, and family social service, which means 5.3 goes directly to kids, and then let's say that obviously some of the food stamp is going to go to kids, right? And some of the unemployment benefits are going to go to kids through their parents. So let's add that together. Am I right? Did I do this right? We pay more to retire, to keep up with our national debt than we pay for children and families. Which is absolutely, I mean, I sort of knew this, but when I actually sat down and saw these two figures together, it really becomes very staggering.
Yeah. Just a point, I didn't realize you could get, what kind of health care or aid, health aid are we giving for children?
Well, no, the only, if you're, there's two different kinds. All right, and they're all, and it's all indexed according to your family's income level. If you're poor and you're on welfare, you get something which in Illinois is called the green card, which is a medical card, which allows you to go to a doctor, and then that doctor bills the welfare department. So it's a form of nationalized insurance.
But not all doctors take it.
But not all doctors take it because it's a, yeah.
I didn't know that existed.
Right, yeah, no, so that's been in existence for a while.
But isn't that usually state-supported, not federal-supported?
It's usually a combination. The most welfare payments are state and federally supported, with, for children and women, the majority of the money coming from the federal government. It's a match, like a two-thirds, one-third match or something like that. The states can augment it, and some states have much better programs than other states because they're willing to augment it. The welfare payments, both the medical and the payments that go to a single individual that's on welfare who is not disabled and is not a senior citizen and is not a mother or child, that's not paid by the welfare system, that's paid by the state. It's usually called general assistance. And that's a different program. It's usually less money and not as good. And the other kind of programs are like WIC. Oh, that's a great program. I love WIC. I mean, WIC is a program. It's called, it was a program that was passed under Nixon, but he refused to fund it. And then it finally got a little through, but not very much. And then Carter really got into it and funded it. And then Reagan has been trying to cut it, but he hasn't cut it as much as he wanted to because it's so successful. What WIC is a program is for pregnant and lactating parents, and then the children. If you're impoverished, that you get supplements if you're pregnant and lactating for the mother, and then once the child is born, you can get supplements in terms of nutritional supplements for the child and infant formula.
Women, infant, children, right?
Yeah, and it's a very successful program. It doesn't reach close to the number of people it should reach. It has bad outreach. There isn't enough money to reach everybody, so they don't do outreach to tell everybody about it. But the statistics have shown that just in short-term medical costs, that there's a 1 in 3. In other words, for every dollar you spend on WIC, the society saves $3 in other medical costs. I'm saying that's just a very conservative kind of thing that the Department of Agriculture
has done. Haven't there been bills just recently, though, that have added something to it? I thought that WIC had been augmented just recently through some real heavy legislation and through Bread for the World letters and stuff like that.
It hasn't been. If it is, it's been in this session, and I haven't gotten any alerts on it because, I mean, there's been, people have wanted to put more money into WIC, but it still doesn't at all meet what it should meet. Which we've been successful in having it not cut back. See, one of the things that's happened in the whole balancing
that's
of the budget.
Yeah, it wasn't cut back.
Yeah. See, if you look at this budget, because we have been unwilling to decrease our defense spending, right? And then also Social Security, one, it would be unfair to decrease it, because really that money, I always think that's unfair to be in the budget because people have put in their retirement money, so it's not quite the same. You know, I always think that it's unfair to keep that in the budget as it is, because it's really a pension program, and it's being used
to balance the budget.
Yeah, it's being used to balance the budget, which is very dangerous.
Show less deficit.
Yeah, in fact, anyhow, and that's a whole other story which we as citizens should be aware of and upset about. But there's nothing, I mean, that's something that they can't decrease. They've been using it incorrectly. They've been borrowing against it and using it so you don't get totally freaked out by the figures. So what really is, you only have this 12.4% and another 1% other, and the agriculture, the 8.4%, the agriculture. So you only have about 20% of the budget that you can cut. So all those balanced budget stuff, it's been all coming out of that 20%, basically. You know, no wonder they can't balance it. You know, I mean, you know, if I try to decrease my spending and I'm only willing to use 20% of my, only modify 20% of my spending habits, and they happen to be the ones that are housing me and educating me, you know, you're going to get into a real problem there. Now, I said earlier, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on health because I want to get into employment issues, but obviously health is super important. Both in terms, because if you're not healthy, you're not going to do well in school, and there's been a lot of stuff that showed that you're going to be sickly all your life. You're going to have problems. Da, 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 da. So that only, I think, makes some logical sense. Plus, you have a right to a healthy body. I think, at least I think. But in terms of education, there's a whole lot of interesting stuff. Nearly one half of all poor youth or have reading and math skills that place them in the bottom 20%. Okay? So you have 50% of the poor youth being in the bottom 20% in terms of reading and math skills. Now, the conservative figure for dropouts in this country is 16%. However, they only take the kids who are sophomores in high school and say how many of them completed at 18. So if someone had dropped out of school before then, those figures aren't completed. In Chicago, where they've done a little better and they still have good figures, it's over 50%.
Go ahead.
We have a dropout rate of approximately 50% in the public schools in Chicago.
I think the same in California. They say California is just incredible, where my son-in-law teaches.
It's really amazing. It is.
Was there an equation there, Sam?
The cause and effect.
Minnesota may have the highest retention rate, but it's not good. Minnesota may have the highest retention rate, but it's not good.
not what it should be. Now, in fact, in this country, up until the 1960s, you know, like a lot of our grandparents or great-grandparents didn't finish high school. And in fact, from the 1900s to 1960s, every year, a few more people graduated from high school. But the figure has been flat since 1960. We haven't had any improvement. It's gone a little down one year, a little up one year. It was like 73.4, and then, you know, I mean, it basically has just stayed there. That also another problem is that kids go to, when they start to go to school, if they're from impoverished back, not always if they're from impoverished backgrounds, but because of a lot of other things that go on, often are behind before they start. And the Head Start program, which has been phenomenally successful, I mean, researchers love the Head Start program because it's been going long enough, they can do research and they can show that it works. But the problem is we still underfund it. It doesn't reach everybody that it should reach. But it's clear that if you have a good Head Start program, and if it was even before that, it would be better, that those children not only finish school, are less likely to be teen parents, are less likely to commit crimes, and are less likely to go on to drugs. So all the kinds of things, and more likely than to get jobs, clearly are tied into, you know, getting a good Head Start. Now the other part of the Head Start program that's very important, I know I wasn't going to say that much about health, is the health part of the Head Start program. It's clear that that has also been one of the things, that if you're getting all this learning stimulation and you have a healthy body.
Difference in dropout rates if you correct for class. You know, in other words, if you take a middle class black child and a middle class white child, there are not that many difference in the dropout rate. If you take a poor white child and a poor black child, there aren't the difference. The difference is looking at poor and middle class and rich. That's the difference. And the average black poor child, 33, one-third, are going to drop out of school, and the average white, 30.2. So that's another figure. Now, if you're a young parent, what happens if you decide to be a young parent? One-third of the mothers under 20 receive AFDC in any given year. Especially if they're unmarried. Three-quarters of the unmarried young parents will be on welfare sometime in the first 4 years after they give birth. All right, so clearly there's a tie in there. Now, blacks are twice as likely to be on welfare because they're less likely to marry. Why are they less likely to marry? Well, William Julius Wilson has this very interesting theory, which part of which I'll prove later, but it's that you marry when there's a man to marry. It takes two to tango, but it takes two to marry. And if you have a situation in which I'll give you the unemployment figures, remember I just showed you how that people aren't earning enough money to support a family, right? And you know that welfare discourages a couple. It's harder for a couple to be on welfare than a single person to be on welfare. But also, because there's such high employment in the black community, the young man can't find a job anyway, in many cases. Or because he can't find a job, he's likely to be into drugs or to have tried a life of crime because he sees other people making more money and functioning as a drug dealer or something like that. I'm not trying to give an unreal profile, but if you take all of those young males away and you take the fact that the most highest murder rates is among young black males, so what that means is there aren't enough marriageable males around. So that they aren't there to marry. And so that's one of the reasons that you get that unmarried rate. There are other reasons. But one of the things that a lot of people are beginning to is looking at the numbers and just saying they aren't there. You know, if he's in jail, or if he's on drugs, or if he's been killed, you know, that means that there's no father around. Right. Now, But say that there is a person, and then you're going to have a problem, which I think is becoming more and more, which some of the stuff is children having children. And one of the statistics, which is very scary, is the number of teenage parents whose parents were teenage parents. You know, and what that means in terms of the whole situation. Okay, so now you're looking for a job. You got someone who really would like a job, right? You know, they're really willing to work. Well, the minimum wage, as I said, is $3.35 an hour, which has been unchanged for 1981. Now, we know what's happened to inflation towards 1981, so to answer your question, the minimum wage is worth less now than it was 7 years ago, or for that matter, 10 years ago. That another thing is happening at the same time is the percentage of jobs that are blue-collar, agricultural, and manufacturing have decreased. Now, like in the 1900s, 1/6 of the jobs in this country were white-collar or service, and 5/6 of the job basically were agriculture, manufacturing, blue-collar of one level or another. Now, 50% of the jobs are white-collar or service, and that the agricultural and blue-collar jobs that remain need a lot more reading and writing skills. And that's one reason education used to play, because if you dropped out of school in the 1900s or even in the 1950s, or you didn't do well in school, you could still get a job in a mill or in a factory, and you could support a family. That is no longer as true. And so that's one of the real big problems. So there's also this structural problem happening about the change in the job market. You have this poverty situation, and then you have this economic situation, this job training, which is affecting a lot of us in terms of a real difference. So for example, in 1984, between the men 25 and 65 who had not finished high school, they only earned 78% of what a person who finished high school, a man who finished high school, would, you know, learn. Now there's an interesting, again, chart, which I just, let's see if I can, I'm gonna write this. So hopefully, does anybody, I can give you this again later, but it's just sort of interesting and made me think about what am I going to do when I grow up. Here's the current jobs, and here's new jobs. Okay? Now, a job where you can have 8 years or less education, okay, currently 6%. The new jobs are being created, only 4%. I mean, it's still pretty low. And so right there you see a problem. Then
that's even assuming that you have the skills that are up to grade level within
right,
8 years.
Right, exactly.
Of education.
Exactly.
And most of the time people who have that little education don't have the skills that go with it.
That's totally correct. So 1 to 3 years of high school currently is 12%. The new job creation is only 10%. Then 1 to 4 years of high school, it is currently 40%. And the new job creation is only 35%. Then 1 to 3 years of, this is high school, this is college, it is 20% and is 22, then 4 years of college or more is 22% now and is going to be 30, is being created in terms of 30%. and the median years of school, so current jobs, is 12.8, and these are 13.5. But I mean, basically, I just want, I mean, there is clearly a trend toward you need more education to be able to get a job. And on the other end, this is the needs of the individual. Society needs a more educated person in order to function and to be competitive in the world economy, which is why all these businesses now are suddenly concerned. I've mentioned this to you before, but there's a selfish need now of a lot of corporations to be concerned about the educational system, because they are, you know, in Chicago, they are not getting typists who can type letters. You know, and the school system, your point, they've gone through the school system, but they really, just because they have a degree doesn't mean that they are the learning skills of that degree. And so there's many more retraining programs in corporations. They're starting to see this problem. And also the other thing that's happening is the birth rates among middle class families is decreasing. Among poor families is basically staying the same. And so what that means is, and the fertility rates of, for example, you know, this is where teen parents comes in, everything like that. So what's basically happening is 1 out of 5 children of the class of 2000, if you remember, I talked to you there, if you were in my session a couple of whenever it was, I've lost track, 2 or 3 days ago, 1/5 of those are children born in poverty. And so what's happening is there are now a larger portion of the job market pool. Also, another interesting statistic is like 8 or 9 years ago, there were like 7 or 8 workers for every person who's retired. Now there's like 3 workers for every person who's retired. There are 3 people working to support one person who's retired. By the beginning of the 21st century, it'll be something like 1.7 workers for every person who's retired. So you see what? I mean, so that's, it's a little off, but I just wanted to show you it all interconnects together in terms of how you figure out how to solve these problems and why people are saying what they're saying. That's one of the things it has to figure out. The official youth employment rate or unemployment rate for 1987 is 16.9%. 16.9% of the youth who want to find jobs cannot find jobs. For blacks, it's 34.9%. That's greater than the Great Depression. There, in the black and poor communities in this country, they have the same exact conditions in terms of the number of people unemployed and stuff like that as there were during the Great Depression. Well, listen to this. I didn't even understand this one until I was researching. Less than 1/2 of all high school graduates younger than 20 and not in college hold full-time jobs. The rest hold, less than half hold full-time jobs. The rest all hold part-time jobs. In the 1960s, 2/3 held full-time jobs. So you're 18 years old, you graduated high school, you're looking for a job, you have less than a 50% chance that you're going to be able to get a full-time job, when if you graduated high school in the 1960s, you had 2/3 of a chance. You had 2 in 3 chances of having a job. And if you've dropped out, it's even worse. Only 1 in 3 male dropouts and 1 in 7 female dropouts younger than 20 work full time.
I'll play devil's advocate here.
Yeah.
When I graduated in 69 from high school, I was willing to put work full time. I Park, I occasionally work in a position where I get high school students coming through, or the 18, the 19, 20-year-olds, and they can't be bothered. They want to be paid, but the arrogance of some of them totally blows me away. And I lose a little sympathy. Because when I graduated from high school, yes, I did have a full-time job, and I was willing to put in my full-time. But I run into these 19, 20-year-olds, and...
Well, you know, it's real interesting.
They want this, and they want that, and they want...
They want to just poop off?
No. I don't know. I only see them in my small little corner. But so much of it is the attitude, we owe them a job, as opposed to they owe us the full 6 to 8 hours worth of work. They tend to come with that attitude.
Well, interesting. I don't know. I mean, I've had this experience myself. I mean, I think it's an anecdotal experience that is real. You know, I mean, part of it, which is actually one of the things I'm doing next week, is how the nature of work has changed and how people look at work and their work habits, which I don't just think is true of youth, which goes in what does that mean for society? I just want to say I think that there's that going on. The other thing that's going on for some and not all of these youth, because of the stuff we talked about, the minimum wage, the job scale that they enter compared to what they see that they need to live and to what they see in some places that they can earn illegally is a lot less. And this is true in the urban community. And that then puts less value on the job because they're putting less value on themselves. I mean, there's that cycle. The other interesting thing, there's this whole thing that came out, and this is another thing that's in this book of William Julius, but there is this whole theory that happened that because of welfare and stuff like that, people have come dependent and it's ruined people's work capacity and the whole culture of poverty. You know, the stuff that's come out in the lab, it's a really conservative critique of the welfare system, which this guy is saying is not true. And he says it's interestingly enough, the point is, and the conservatives would say that because of these poor work habits, which I think is some of the picture, but that people wouldn't work even if they're offered jobs. You know, the story is I see a lot of jobs in the paper and people won't take the jobs. But interestingly enough, when you start to do a comparison, you know, the Boston area in Massachusetts, what's happened is because of the real economic resurgence of that area, the high tech and everything that's occurred in that area, not only has there been a resurgence of those kind of jobs, but there's been enough of a trickle down that there's more service jobs, and there's more houses being built, you know, and there's more of those kinds of jobs happening. And what happened, interestingly enough, is the unemployment rate, we'll say, in the black poor community in Boston is correspondingly lower. So where there is an expanding economy and where there are jobs offered, that that culture of poverty no longer works. In fact, they do go to work, and where you have that large rate of people who say they won't work, it's where there aren't the jobs or enough jobs to create an optimism of going out. So, you know, but I still, the other question, the first thing which I responded to, which is a whole different question, is what is it about work that everyone, I think I'm less into work than my mother was. I mean, and I think that, I mean, and I think both in a good way and a bad way, actually.
No, I get irritated that I'm sitting here, it's retail work.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's indoors, it's dry. I have a bathroom closed, and where I work, they pay better than minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And for fresh out of high school, mm-hmm. I think it's pretty darn good. Mm-hmm.
Are they going to school or anything?
I don't know. I just I I worked at, I just fill in, that's my outlet. I work at the switchboard, and it happens to be at the switchboard. That's where you drop off your purses. And just the arrogance of these kids coming through. They haven't worked a full shift yet, and they all really want their discount card to buy, go out and buy clothes. The way they treat me just handling their purse, I get, you know, I have a real hard time building up a lot of sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
So
I work with a lot of student nurses who go to a university. They all go full time to school, and then some of them, I'd say half of them hold on another full time.
And I bet you get better work out of them.
But what I'm saying is, I know a lot of students now because there's no aid. They work and they also go to school. I don't know.
This is the impression. This is the kids out of high school. They're kind of finding themselves or whatever. But no, you can tell the ones that are indeed going to school. And
they have a purpose in the future, I think.
Yeah, they have a purpose. But to me, I've been out, I've poured cement with my husband, I've worked in the rain, and to me it's a good deal. And I get really irritated. But I don't know when my class graduated, were there just as many out there, just as irritated?
You know, when we graduated, it was an expanding economy. And there was a sense, which was partially true and partially not true, that the sky was the limit. You know, and that is no longer true. The sky is no longer the limit. You know, this generation is going to be worse off than we are.
But I also graduated with the idea that I didn't want to, I had worked in a fabric store since my sophomore year. I knew I did not want to work in a fabric store until I was 65.
Right. No, I know that. But I'm just saying that there was this view that you could do with it. I'm talking about almost a psychological sense of things. And I think that had some effect. You know, that I'm not sure it's true. Listen to this figure, which goes in between 1973 and 1986. Okay, so that's the figures. The average, now we're adjusting for inflation, you know, because money means less now than it did then. You know, you can buy less and all that stuff. So you've adjusted the earnings. Now we're doing males 20 to 24 again. It fell by 25%. So the average earnings adjusted for inflation of males from 20 to 24 fell by 25% from 1973 to 1986. And for young black males, it fell 50%.
Mm-hmm. Explain how they tell you that the unemployment figures are down. You know, you hear that on the radio every once in a while.
Well, for one thing,
what is that fluctuation about? You know.
Well, it comes from a lot of different places. One thing is unemployment is people who are looking for work. So if you stop looking for work, you're no longer in the unemployment figures. Is that understood? Okay. You have to go in and be registered with an employment service looking for work. All right, so that's number one. Number two, that certain parts of the economy are expanding. But still, the unemployment rates now are much, much higher than they were 20 or 25 years ago. You know, and there are stubborn pockets of structural unemployment. So as you can see, in this area, it's increasing, right? That there are more, you know, and what's happening is the economy is moving a little better now. There was these stagnations. I'm not a real good economist, and I wish I understood this a little more. And so things in certain regions, like where I live doesn't happen to be the case, in certain regions the economy is a little less stagnant than it was before and it's picking up. Now one of the things the unemployment rate doesn't show, and it reflects some of these figures I talked to you about now, is that while some of these jobs, which need more reading and writing skills and everything, pay a lot more, that you know, the person who was working in the steel mills in the south side of Chicago was getting very good money. We'll say $24,000 a year. I'm just, you know, that man who got laid off now is having to accept a job that pays $12,000 or $14,000 a year. Now, he's no longer unemployed, right, when he takes that new job.
Okay.
And so that's another thing which is occurring. So when I say the average inflation of males 20 to 24 fell by more than 25%, a lot of it is that a lot of these service jobs pay less. Some of them, obviously, some of the high tech pay more, but a lot of them pay less.
But he's still employed.
He's still employed.
Yeah.
Like, for example, a woman who worked in a factory, it's a much dirtier job. She would be paid more on the whole than a woman who worked at Marsha Fields. Mm-hmm. You know,
in a case here last week when Janet Wingo was here, a black woman from Detroit,
mm-hmm.
she had just lost. She was working on a car assembly line, had been making $30,000 a year, and she was just laid off.
Mm-hmm.
And was in fear of losing her whole home and everything because she was going to go John Penny when she got back home.
Yeah.
So I see that. That's helpful.
One other thing I think we all, I mean, I feel this is especially true of women, but I think it's true of all of us. We have to understand the economics a lot better than we do. You know what I mean? It's just, it affects so many other things that we're concerned about, and not only for ourselves, but in terms of justice issues and quality of life. And, you know, they say these things, and I'm starting to understand it, but a lot of times I think they're talking Chinese. If they were talking Greek, I'd understand them naturally, but Chinese I haven't yet caught
no.
on.
Oh,
yeah. So I only have a few minutes left, as usual. I've talked too long. But I think if you're looking at what are the reasons for this situation, why the young are poor, you know, and especially, and again, now we're talking about especially the young adolescent worker, why are they poor and how can they get out of this hole that they're dug into? One is a lack of education. And unless we deal with our educational system, because of these changes that are just going on and everything we've talked about, and we're not only talking about someone who stays in school, but someone who gets educated to a certain level, or else it's not going to work. The next thing that's important is because of the thing I mentioned earlier, but I haven't proven to you, so you're going to have to take my word, is that so much of finding a job, and this I think you'll agree with me, are informal networks of knowing how to look for a job or knowing someone. I mean, I was thinking back, when my first job was working at a bakery store, and it was a friend of my mother's. My mother worked as a checkout woman in a grocery store, and one of the people in the grocery store told her about the job. My mother started saying, my daughter's looking for a summer job, and I got it. That was my first job at 16, and then again, it was another customer of my mother's who told me about a job in a dry goods store where I worked all through the rest of high school. And then my cousin's sister-in-law worked for household finance, and then I worked there as a bookkeeper for 2 years. And so really all of my youth employment was through these little networks. You know, and if even it wasn't a person you knew directly, it was a friend of a friend kind of thing. And also, I've learned skills of how to find a job and look for a job. But really, you know, my mother.
I think one thing the problem is here that everybody thinks everybody should go to school till 18. For instance, in Austria, you go to the you finish with school at 15 if you want to, and usually only the people that want higher education keep going on till 18. But the kids that come out at 15, they go to a 3-year apprenticeship program where they get paid, it's not a full wage, on 2 days a week they go to school. 2 mornings a week they go to school on the rest of work, and they get skilled in everything as an apprenticeship, even selling in the store. But it does sort of not force everybody to stay in school till 18, because not everybody is suitable to stay in school till 18.
And we do not have a good vocational track. It's often that not only isn't it that good, and it's often lower status, and so less people are going to go into it, but also it isn't kept up with technology. So you're trained in a kind of auto mechanics there no longer is, you know, or you're not trained in word processing, you're still working on an electric typewriter. I'm just, you know, giving you some different examples. And this country has not really, it's starting to, but not really done a very good job of that. The next issue are the lack of education and the dysfunctioning communities, the whole network thing I said earlier, that they're, if you have a poor community with a high unemployment rate, you're less going to network than in a community that has a lower, it's one of these self-fulfilling prophecies kind of situations, is the structural thing I talked about earlier, that the poor, especially the minority poor, are often in situations that that right now, that the kind of jobs that the poor used to do in this country that paid a living wage happen to be the same kind of jobs that are disappearing in this country, which is the manufacturing jobs. So, and so that that has added salt to the wound, or it's increased the situation, you know, through no fault of any, you know, their own or anything. And I don't think any paranoid plot by anyone. This is let's get these people. That you know, I mean, the only paranoid plot in terms of racism is historically those were the only jobs they got, so they were disproportionately put in those jobs. You know, I mean, if for example, it had been even if we had no racism and no problems of discrimination in this country, and everything was equally distributed, and then that we would still have a problem with losing those jobs, but it wouldn't impact so greatly on one community or in a couple of communities. So it wouldn't be as concentrated, and then do that sort of really geometric thing that then occurs within the lack of education, the morale, the no networking, and stuff like that. It would still be a real big problem, though. And then finally, because the federal policy has not increased the minimum wage, again, in terms of youth in particular, I think that becomes a problem. I mean, it doesn't even cost them anything. And by the way, I want to say this, that when they tried to raise the minimum wage the last time they did it, which was in the late 70s, and a lot of forces like Chamber of Commerce and stuff like that were against it, they said, well, you know, if we raise the minimum wage, a lot of businesses will go out of business and they won't hire people. You know, that argument? Well, in fact, they raised the minimum wage and the number of jobs increased. So it could have been, you know, there could have been for another reason, but I just want to say it didn't happen. Their prophecy that raising the minimum wage would decrease the number of jobs for young people in particular and everyone in general didn't hold true. That argument didn't work. Now, I want to give you some ideas about what are things that I think would work. And again, in this country, it isn't that we don't do things that work. Is that we never do them long enough and they don't become consistent policy. I mean, it isn't like, you know, I was going to tell you a story, this is completely off the subject, but I was sitting with this black doctor, a woman who is now in her 70s, and we were talking about new ways to fight infant mortality, and she turned to me and she said, "Dear, when I was in Washington during the 30s, we were talking exactly about those same kinds of things, you know. It was, you know, the same kinds of ideas of having a lot more visiting nurses and going out to the communities and having prenatal care." And it isn't like any of this is, you know, creative new ideas. But one is the Job Corps. Remember the Job Corps? You know, that's one of the federal programs that has decreased. In other words, less money has been put into it. It's that 12% I've erased down here. But it worked. It was a situation of taking youth that often were aimless, who dropped out of school who didn't have vocational skills, putting them in a concentrated situation, giving them getting them out of an environment that was sometimes destructive to them, giving them skills in a highly concentrated way, having mentors for them, having some networking back in society, teaching, it worked. That, if we just expanded on that, that would be very useful.
One other thing, though, I think, maybe because I work with so many women, is child care. In low income or middle income, even upper income, you know, trying to find child care so that you can work.
50% of all 50% of families with, 50% of mothers of preschool children work with me, so it's not a majority.
Isn't it higher than that?
Well, no, it's just 50. It just hit the 50% preschool. It's greater than that. Okay. Yeah. And there is no child care in this country. That's going to be one of the big issues. I mean, it's very scattered. There's no national policy of child care. And it is a real family. And often the child care exists. It doesn't have good standards. And so the quality of child care is in question.